chapter 24, which tells of the meeting with Mate and with the caravan leader. Good Fortune was a great believer in early rising, so they were all sitting at their morning tea while it was still dark and cold. Uncle Chen, whose habits were quite different, sat huddled over the fire, cold and miserable, but tried to look pleasant and said solemnly, "I wish the gentleman an agreeable journey." Then he looked sharply at Chin, who was stirring a yellowish mixture of roasted barley and adding tea and butter to it. "That's just right," Good Fortune announced. "It can now be eaten as it is, or thinned with tea, and it can be eaten politely or impolitely, just as a fellow likes." "Is it a Mongolian dish?" asked Christian. "No," replied Good Fortune. "It's a Tibetan dish called tsamba, set to. Tsamba is just the right food for old caravan men." At first, Christian and Big Tiger poked around in the thick mush with their chopsticks, but then they decided to follow Chin, who had put the bowl to his mouth and was pushing the mush in with his chopsticks. "If my Amma saw this," thought Christian, but he didn't get time to imagine what her words of reproach for such bad table manners would be, for Good Fortune said, "The best way with tsamba is to let it run into your mouth." They all followed this simple advice, and Christian and Big Tiger found that tsamba tasted fine. "I've given you the best kind with sugar in it," said Uncle Chen patronizingly. "It's a first-class luxury, a real feast." There was no more conversation, for indeed it was impossible to talk while eating tsamba. Then Good Fortune lit the lantern, and Uncle Chen went out before him in Greencoat to the storage tent, behind which the ass had lain down. "You won't plague me much longer, you old baller," said Chen. "Hold your tongue," snarled Greencoat, giving him a nudge. "I only meant," said Chen apologetically, "that next time he'll have two stones on his tail. Really, that's all I meant." On the eastern horizon, the sky was brightening, the stars were growing pale, and one could already see how black the cliffs of Murukchik were and how light the surrounding hills, and also that it would be a beautiful day. This made Good Fortune very cheerful. "Heaven is kind to us," he cried. "Take your seats, men. The light is rising over the earth." Christian hurriedly gave Chin a handful of honey cakes. Then Good Fortune sounded the horn, and the motor started humming. Chen and Chin stood bowing for a long time by the side of the caravan road. Only when the yurts had grown small in the distance did the travelers see Chen turning back and Chin skipping off. "Now he'll take the stone off the ass's tail," said Big Tiger. "And then he'll go with the telegram," said Christian anxiously. "It's a miserable business," sighed Big Tiger in deep gloom. Christian buried his head in his fur coat and thought unhappily of the perplexing nature of many things. Why had Big Tiger not let him speak up yesterday evening? And why had he lied again to Good Fortune, saying he knew only half the contents of the telegram? Christian didn't understand why Big Tiger was coming out with so many lies these days. Big Tiger was meditating, too. "You must be broad-minded, Kwee Chan," he said. "You and I know a lot of things, but we must not let anyone know about them." "Especially Greencoat," said Christian. "No, especially Good Fortune," Big Tiger disagreed. "Why so?" asked Christian, wondering why exactly Good Fortune should not know anything. "To open your mouth is dangerous," Big Tiger declared. "To keep it shut is safe. Good Fortune must never guess that we know anything about his bargain with Greencoat." "Aha," said Christian. "But why?" "Because Good Fortune would lose face. That mustn't happen. And we must manage things so that he always appears to be a man of honor. In this way, we'll keep him as our friend. That's why I..." "Do you understand?" "I understand now," said Christian. "Anyone who lies once has to lie many times," said Big Tiger, sadly. "Don't be shocked, Kwee Chan, if you hear me coming out with lies." "I won't be surprised any more," promised Christian. "We mustn't say anything to Good Fortune about the gasoline or about Tsing Tsing Xia, so I must now think up what I'm to say when he asks me what was written in the telegram." "I'll think, too," said Christian, "and in the end I'll get an idea. You mustn't have to tell all the lies." He tucked himself deeper into his coat and drew the fur cap over his ears, and Big Tiger did the same. They looked out for the little pink clouds in the east, but they had become pale and thin, and when the sun rose majestically in the clear sky, they disappeared altogether. An hour later, there was no more grass to be seen. There were more and more stones, and there was a low, flat mountain ridge which pushed its spurs from the north into the valley, like the fingers of an outstretched hand. The first spur promised an easy ascent, and the caravan road could be seen going up the gentle slope. Despite this, Good Fortune left the road at this point and turned southward into a somewhat uninviting, boulder-strewn slope. The truck clattered for a while over rough stones until it reached a broad basin, which, however, only prepared the way to a second stony slope. These alternations were repeated several times until a valley opened up, sharply cut through by a watercourse, which broke the monotony of the landscape. Bastions of loess, 10 to 14 feet high, bordered the riverbed, indicating the force of the water which had made a way through. But the riverbed was full of stones instead of water, and it was only when the valley broadened out that clumps of reeds could be seen, with a pool here and there among them. The mountain ridge in the north curved backward in a perfect semicircle and then flattened out. From this semicircle, the caravan road emerged through a rocky gorge into the low, flat country, and it was easy now to see why Good Fortune had diverged from it. On the edge of the fields of reeds stood a yurt. Sheep were grazing on the mountain slope, and the heads of camels appeared above the reeds. It was nearing midday when Good Fortune halted by the yurt. "Get out," he cried. "We are in the valley of dark rushing water, and this is probably the last yurt we shall see before we reach the Etzen Gaul." "Bolna," said Christian, slipping out of his fur coat.
"Have you got any ideas?" whispered Big Tiger.
"I know what we've got to say. Let me speak if Good Fortune questions us."
"Have you considered everything?" asked Big Tiger anxiously. "It must be a good lie."
"It's a very good lie, because it's quite simple," Christian replied confidently. They got down. An old man was standing there, and he greeted them like long-awaited friends. His wife shooed off two terrifying, tooth-gnashing dogs, which were as big and fierce as dogs must be, which have to fight wolves on their own. They were brown and white and had thick ruffs round their necks, like young lions. After the salutations, which Christian and Big Tiger got through almost without faltering, the old man invited them in. Instead of a curtain, the yurt had a little two-winged door which stood open, revealing a home of modest comfort. Good Fortune and Greencoat entered first, then came Big Tiger and Christian, and finally the master of the house. When they were seated in order of rank, the woman also came in, brightened up the fire, and put on water for tea. Christian and Big Tiger noticed that the yurt was quite different from Serchi's poor tent, or Uncle Chen's smoke-blackened yurt, and far more magnificent.
"I'd like to stay here," whispered Christian.
"Happiness dwells in this worthy palace," said Big Tiger calmly. The felt walls were new and white, and trimmed with blue. They shimmered through the black framework on which a board hung near the door, covered with rows of shining copper vessels. There was a carpet on the floor and piles of red cushions. In the background stood an ancient carved chest, covered with a blue damask haddock. Two lighted butter lamps stood on it, and behind them several silk-bound books. On a raised throne sat a bronze Buddha with the big ears of perfect wisdom. There was a faint perfume of incense and an atmosphere of peace. After an interval of perfect silence, the old Mongol began to speak in a deep voice which neither rose nor fell. Turning to Christian, he said, "Have you been long in the land of the Mongols?" Good Fortune felt impelled to come to Christian's rescue. "The poor foreigner has only known the grassland 4 days," he said. "I am indeed sorry for him," replied the old man. "How sad it must be," said the woman, "not to be born a Mongol."
"It is certainly a misfortune," agreed the old man, "but what luck he has had to have found the way to us."
When the tea was ready, they were given millet and fresh cream cheese, and the old man began to speak again. "My name is Matei," he said, "and every spring I come to the valley of dark rushing water. I have been here 4 days. The water is good. The camels and sheep find enough to eat. I need no more."
"What about the wolves?" asked Good Fortune. "I see your sheep grazing on the mountainside, and nobody with them."
The wolf seldom comes here because there are no antelopes. Hares are also rare, but the big wild sheep live in the mountains. They have horns which the wolf fears, and they are as nimble as the four not alike.
The four not alike?
Asked Greencoat eagerly. He understood the strange word, for it was one of the few he had trouble to pick up.
What is the four not alike?
The four not alike, Mate explained, was a deer, and yet he wasn't a deer, though he had antlers. He had feet like an ox, fur like a mole, and the tail of an ass. That is why he was called the four not alike, and he lived in the woods of the north, where Mongolia ends. I never saw him, but 7 years ago, a widely traveled man who knew everything there is in the world visited me. He had seen the four not alike, and he said he was a terrifying beast with sad eyes.
He probably guessed he would die out, said Good Fortune,
and he translated Mate's story into Chinese.
Then Christian got a bright idea and cried, "The widely traveled man was nowhere at all."
He noticed at once that he had said something indiscreet, but it was too late. He had forgotten Big Tiger's warning that it was dangerous to open one's mouth.
"Nowhere at all?" cried old Mate. "My child, what do you know of that worthy man?"
"And how do you know about him?" asked Good Fortune.
"We have heard this name," Big Tiger hastened to explain, "because Nowhere at All was a celebrated man who was always being spoken of. He is said to have died in the Valley of Dark Rushing Water. More than that, we do not know."
Mate listened attentively. "Yes, it is as you say," he cried, "and Nowhere at All is a man to remember with reverence." For some minutes, there was complete silence. They could hear the fire crackling and the camels treading through the nearby fields of reeds, and one of the dogs began to growl.
"Ajin Chin," said Mate's wife quietly, and then the silence became, if possible, more complete. A note tells us Ajin Chin means caravan.
A thin, distant clanging sound became audible, and each time the clang came nearer, the dogs growled more loudly.
"A trader's caravan," said Greencoat, making a move to stand up.
Mate rose at once and was standing outside the door with his wife before Greencoat had time to stand up.
"Where are your manners?" asked Good Fortune angrily, but Greencoat put on an insolent expression and went out without replying.
"It can't be helped," sighed Good Fortune. "One must suffer the uncouth with patience."
"Where does he want to go to?" asked Christian.
"He's an inquisitive person," said Good Fortune contemptuously, "and he's not ashamed to show it. Did you hear the bells? There are two of them. No, three. That means it's a big caravan. It's coming down through the ravine, and Greencoat wants to know where it is coming from, what it is carrying, and where it is going."
"Take the whip with you," they heard Mate saying, and Greencoat muttered, "Yes, yes."
Mate called back the dogs, and then he came in with his wife.
"He carries on that low profession," said Good Fortune.
"Traders," said the wife tolerantly, "have to pursue what is petty in order to gain what is great." She filled three bowls of milk, and Mate took three white haddocks out of the chest. Then, on his knees, he offered the milk to the guests, one after the other, with the haddock.
"You are honoring us too greatly," said Good Fortune.
"We are unworthy," said Big Tiger and Christian.
They drank a little of the milk and watched Good Fortune raising the haddock to his forehead and then putting it away. Then they did the same, and Good Fortune said, "We do not deserve this honor. We are only wretched travelers."
Mate would not let that pass. They were already close friends, he asserted. Then, in eloquent and poetical language, which even Good Fortune could not understand completely, he spoke of the glory which they had brought to his yurt. "Anyone who knows my true friend Nowhere at All," he said, "is very near to my heart."
"That's you," said Good Fortune, giving Christian a nudge.
"But I don't know him," protested Christian unhappily. "He's dead long ago."
"We beg our esteemed elder not to betray us," said Big Tiger. "It would not be good if Greencoat were to learn of our friendship with the son and grandson of Nowhere at All. The one is called Dogalon, the other Bator."
"Aha," said Good Fortune, "you seem to have made some choice friends. I have indeed heard something of Dogalon.
"But he's not a bad man," cried Christian.
Good Fortune raised his eyebrows and gave Big Tiger and Christian a searching look. He said nothing further, but began to explain to Mate, who was awaiting an explanation, that Dogalon was the son of Nowhere at All, and Bator the son of Dogalon.
"I know that," the unsuspecting Mate replied. "How is Dogalon, and does he still live at the White Stone?"
"He left there 3 days ago," said Good Fortune irritably.
"He's on the way to the Etzen Gaul," Big Tiger announced. "Naidong, who is Bator's grandfather, lives there, and we're to visit him if we find him."
The past thrusts forward into the present as the tree comes forth from the earth, said Mate.
"Have you 2 minutes to spare?"
"We have," said Good Fortune irritably, but then he added politely, "We've lots of time," and smiled, for he wanted his impoliteness to be quickly forgotten.
7 years ago, began Mate, Nowhere at All came to us here. It was early spring, and the nights were cold. He came late in the evening, and after we had become acquainted, we went to bed. The next morning he wanted to ride on, but we begged him to remain, and he told us about all the things there are in the world. We had mutual friends of whom we talked, and as evening fell again, the conversation turned on Yolros Lama.
"We saw the living Buddha in White Stone," said Christian.
"He is like a father and mother," said Big Tiger. "He is kind to man and beast," Mate agreed. "Nowhere at All had a leaf of the sacred tree of Kumbum, which Yolros Lama had bidden him to cast to the winds in the Valley of Dark Rushing Water. But there was no wind." On the evening of the fourth day, Nowhere at All drew a slender little book out of his belt. In it lay the leaf, and many pages of the book were written on.
"I am a bad inquisitive man," said Nowhere at All.
"Can you read?"
"That is an art I do not understand," I told him.
"But you have got many books," he replied. "Why do you keep them?"
"They belong to my firstborn son, who is a lama in the monastery of Ortegolansum."
"We were there also," said Good Fortune, "but we did not stop."
"That's a pity," said Mate. "In Ortegolansum dwell the flower of the wise men of Ordos and Sunit."
"The Sunit Wong was there," remarked Big Tiger, "and his old cousin, too. He is very clever."
"The old cousin is a perfect wise man," said Mate. Nowhere at All had visited him, too, and the learned man had written many things in the little book, which Naidong was to read to him as soon as he reached the Etzen Gaul. A storm had arisen, and the wind was blowing through the Valley of Dark Rushing Water. "I want to obey the command of the holy man," said Nowhere at All, "and I beg you to be my witness." We went out in front of the tent, where the dog was lying, sheltering from the wind. Nowhere at All took out the little book and threw to the winds the leaf of the sacred tree. It flew away, and with it a leaf of the little book. I grasped for it, but it had been whirled away in the storm of the night. "Hamaga," cried Nowhere at All, "it is not right to run after the written word." We went back to the yurt, and I slept until I awoke. But Nowhere at All did not awake. He was already stone cold when I went to call him, so suddenly had he died. When we had mourned him, we bade a lama come, and he decided the place in the mountains where Nowhere at All was to be laid.
"Is he buried far from here?" asked Christian.
"We would like to pay our respects at his grave," said Big Tiger. Good Fortune shook his head.
"You can't do that," he declared, "because there's no grave."
Mate, who understood the gist of the conversation, said, "We Mongols do not bury our dead. We lay them in a place far away, shown us by the Lama, and then we wait 3 days and pray that their wandering soul may be well received on the other side. Their bodies serve as food for the wolves and the eagles. Only the bones of Nowhere at All were left when we went back on the third day. He was a good man, otherwise more of him would have been left."
"What is done then?" asked Big Tiger, horrified.
"Nothing is done," said Mate. "The bones are left where they are."
"But what about the relatives?" asked Big Tiger.
"I sent them word," answered Mate, "and I gave the messenger the camel and everything else belonging to Nowhere at All. But Dogalon sent them all back to me as a gift, and so I got the camel mare, which Nowhere at All rode, and she became the ancestress of our little herd.
Good luck came to us, and since then we have not lost a single sheep by the wolf, and though we withdraw to other pastures in the winter, we come back each spring to the valley of dark rushing water. It's well for us that you do, said Good Fortune, otherwise we wouldn't have met you and heard your words of wisdom. Having paid this compliment, Good Fortune finished his bowl of milk, and this was the sign for departure. Forgive me, said Mate, if I trouble you with a request. There is no question of trouble, said Good Fortune. I would like the young gentleman to take the book to the Etzengal, said Mate, so that Nai Dong may learn the two words written by the Wong's old cousin. Perhaps Nai Dong needs this news urgently. Mate took the little book out of the chest, and Christian received it reverently with both hands. We shall pass on your greetings, he said. Whereabouts does this Nai Dong live? Asked Good Fortune. I am told he lives by the Narengal, said Mate. More than that, I do not know. We shall find Nai Dong, Good Fortune assured him. I know where the Narengal flows. May you dwell in peace. He started up the motor, and Christian and Big Tiger were surprised that he intended leaving without Greencoat. You needn't be afraid, said Good Fortune. We shall meet him on the road. He won't be far off. Get in front. You can change places later. Good Fortune drove off quite slowly, though the ground was smooth enough. As the caravan road came into sight, and they could have heard the bells only for the noise of the truck, he suddenly asked, "What about that telegram? Did you manage to see it?" "Yes, we've seen it," said Big Tiger. "What did it say?" asked Good Fortune. "I believe there were only 6 words in it," said Christian. "One of them was Suchow." "And what were the others?" asked Good Fortune impatiently. "They were no more cow pond, but Suchow, Greencoat," said Christian. "Was that all?" asked Good Fortune, disappointed. "And was there no other name?" "Where?" asked Big Tiger innocently. "At the end where Greencoat was, I mean." "No," said Christian. "There was nothing but Greencoat." "Has Greencoat got 2 names, then?" Big Tiger probed. "I didn't mean that," replied Good Fortune. "I just thought that it was rather brief, only 6 words. "They mean that Chen is going to Suchow," Christian explained proudly. "We found that out." "That wasn't much," growled Good Fortune, beginning to drive faster. "Where is Suchow, honored sir?" asked Big Tiger. "It's on the Silk Road," replied Good Fortune. "But haven't you got a map?" Christian was about to reply that they would look it up, but the car suddenly dipped down, for they were crossing the riverbed of the Valley of Dark Rushing Water. Christian and Big Tiger had to hold on tight to prevent their heads from hitting against the windshield, and then they fell back when the car began to climb up the steep bank at the other side. Good Fortune had to change gear several times. "That was a near thing," he said as they got up again. In front of them they saw the caravan, and the last camel was carrying a heavy copper bell which gave a melancholy boom at each step. Behind was a man guiding a horse by the bridle, and beside him walked Greencoat. When they saw the truck coming, Greencoat stood still, and his companion leapt quickly to his saddle and rode towards the truck, waving at Good Fortune to stop. Now, keep your shirt on," muttered Good Fortune, continuing to drive. Then he slowed down. The man on the horse was quite out of breath. "Can't you hear?" he shouted angrily, "and can't you see?" "I hear and I see that you're a lout," said Good Fortune calmly. "Those who say that one should not converse with such people are right. Therefore, I shall drive on." "Excellency," cried the man, "I ask forgiveness and clemency." "Under these circumstances," said Good Fortune, "I shall listen to you if you wish, but make it short." "I beg you not to ruin me," pleaded the man. "Our camels are carrying heavy loads, but they will take fright and throw them off if they see Your Excellency's car and hear its noise. Therefore, I beg you to turn a little aside and let us pass on in peace." "My eyes are dim," Good Fortune asserted, "and my ears have grown weak from your bawling. Have you got any remedy for this illness?" "We have various remedies," said the man sadly. "Very well. Go fetch me a 20-pound bag of rice. But honest weight, mind." "It will be yours at once," replied the man in a tone of relief, and he galloped off. Good Fortune followed slowly with the truck. When he reached Greencoat, he stopped. "You've taken a fine long walk," he said. "Did you have an interesting conversation?"
"Yes," answered Greencoat, "and those who say a man should only have intercourse with his own kind are right."
"Are you referring to the lout on the horse?" asked Good Fortune good-humoredly.
"He's the leader of this great caravan and a virtuous man. How can you call him a lout?"
"Has he given you a gift?" asked Good Fortune.
"It is not customary to make gifts on the road," said Greencoat sternly. "That's out of date," Good Fortune enlightened him. "You will see presently what is customary nowadays." And he sat down near Greencoat, beside the camel track.
Christian and Big Tiger got out, too. When they saw the rider coming back, they climbed quickly up on the truck again, and then they heard the horse stopping and the man saying, "I have hastened back to you before you overtake us, honored sir. Please accept my poor gift."
"You may put it in the truck," said Good Fortune graciously.
Christian and Big Tiger got ready to help the man. He tried to heave the sack over the side of the car, but his horse was restive and frightened by the humming of the engine. At last he got it near enough, and then Christian took hold of one end and Big Tiger the other. "Thanks 10,000 times," they said, but it was of little avail. The man was in a rage. His eyes gleamed with hatred. He muttered "little scoundrels" between his teeth, gave his horse a blow of the whip, and galloped off. Good Fortune winked complacently and tapped Greencoat on the shoulder. "Do you see now," he said, "what is customary when people meet on the road?"
"Old Hung Hootse," muttered Greencoat, and then he asked if he might drive.
"No," said Good Fortune. "From here to Durban Mott, the road is much too difficult for beginners." Greencoat put on a forced smile.
"I quite agree with you," he said. "Please forgive me."
At first Good Fortune drove straight on, and then he turned out to the left. Be it said to his credit that he made a very wide detour around the caravan, so that none of the camels could be the least frightened. Thus they could survey the whole caravan from end to end. There were definitely more than 300 camels in it, and Christian tried to count them, but each time he got to 24 or 30, he became uncertain and started again from the beginning. "Just count the drivers," Big Tiger advised. "There are 25, including the one who goes right out in front," Christian announced. "Then," said Big Tiger, and he paused for a moment, "then there are 325 camels, or a few more." Christian was astonished, but as most Chinese boys are expert at figures, he only asked casually, "How do you make that out?" "By taking 13 as the number to reckon," Big Tiger explained. 13, or at most 15 camels, are tied together, one behind the other by their nose ropes, and one man guides the lot. So you have only to multiply 25 men by 13, and you know how many camels there are."
"So that's it," said Christian. "But what about the man on the horse?"
"He's the leader of the caravan. You don't count him, and I hope we'll never meet him again. He was terribly angry."
"We shouldn't have said thanks 10,000 times. He took that badly."
"We shouldn't have helped him to put the sack in the truck," declared Big Tiger. "Now he takes us for apprentice Redbeards. Did you see his eyes? They were like fiery coals, and his hair bristled so much that it lifted up his hat," said Big Tiger.
"Let's not bother about him," said Christian cheerily. "He's far away."
They looked back once more at the caravan, and it seemed like a writhing centipede left far behind. Good Fortune then took to the caravan road again, and before long the smooth plateau changed to rough terrain. The path wound through endless low dome-shaped hillocks, and often the truck slid over into the sand when the track was not wide enough. At the foot of the little hills lay sand drifts, which made progress still more difficult. Good Fortune breathed a sigh of relief when the ground rose higher and the maze of low hills ceased. The road led imperceptibly into a basin-like depression. There was a well there, surrounded by a spacious camping place. But suddenly the view became obstructed on all sides. True, the road, which turned sharply northward, could still be seen, but that was about all. Now it vanished behind jutting crags. Now it appeared in defiles. But on the whole, it seemed to be the only negotiable track in all that maze. Good Fortune ignored it, nevertheless, and steered resolutely toward an upper slope, which proved to be not so steep as it appeared. All the same, it took all his skill during an arduous hour to reach the foot of a mountain ridge which led to the west. To the south was sheer desert.
"Sand!" cried Christian in dismay. "Where can so much sand come from all at once?"
He took out the map and magnifying glass. Then he noticed the small, closely placed dots near a nameless chain of hills. Not far from this, there was a blue semicircle indicating a well, and beside it the words Durban Mott.
"Now we are really in the desert," said Christian apprehensively.
"The sea of sand is terrifying only to the timid," Big Tiger remarked.
But he himself did not sound very happy.
"What surprises me," he continued slowly and wonderingly,
"is how good fortune can find his way about here," Christian completed the sentence. Big Tiger nodded, and both gazed out on the long waves of dunes which broke against the slope. The sand dazzled their eyes. It was only late afternoon, and Good Fortune was driving as if it were a matter of life and death, but he had to be very careful, for the car was all the time tilted slightly against the slope. Later, the sand receded a little, the dunes got flatter, and at last they came to a dilapidated group of trees. That was Durban Mott, the place of the four trees, and the well was also there. Good Fortune now drove more slowly, for he knew that he was coming to a gravel-filled basin. When he reached it, he halted. "Enough for today," he said.
"There's nobody here," remarked Greencoat. "Where shall I sleep tonight? You should have brought a tent."
"Peculiar young fellow," said Good Fortune, and left Greencoat standing there. This was a very offensive thing to say, and Good Fortune made it worse by following it with a laugh. "Ha!" Then he set to work to pour water into the radiator and cover the hood up. "You must fetch fresh water," he said. "The well is just beside the trees, but take a rope, as there's no hoist." The trees were black poplars, bent over by the wind. Only one stood upright. It was impossible to imagine how they had managed to take root and become trees here in gravel and sand with hardly any earth, and how the branches continued to put forth leaves again and again, even when the crowns lay on the ground, smothered in sand drifts. The poplars grew at the other side of the gravelly basin, just where it narrowed and firm ground began again. A stone's throw away, the sand dunes drifted in waves from the south against the slope. From the north came the stream of boulders. It rose gradually out from the broad bed, and then suddenly climbed steeply halfway up the mountain wall. There it disappeared in a ravine, from which the caravan road wound in spirals down to the valley. Good Fortune came running after them over the field of gravel, carrying a shovel. "Stop!" he shouted. "We have to clean up a bit first." The well was covered with boards, from which he carefully removed the sand. Then he shoveled the gravel aside. "If everyone did this," he declared, "there wouldn't be so many choked-up wells." When he pushed the boards aside, the mirror of water could be seen glittering scarcely 10 feet down. It was so clear that every little stone could be seen distinctly at the bottom, and when Christian let down the pail, it came up almost half-empty, so he had to draw several times before he got a bucketful. "Most caravans go an hour's journey further," said Good Fortune. "There's another well there which has lots of water, but there's soda in it, and it gives you stomach ache."
"Then we'd rather stop here," said Christian.
"But where will Greencoat sleep?" asked Big Tiger mischievously.
"He says he needs a tent."
"We haven't got a tent," said Good Fortune, "and we don't need one. Just look around you. Could you find a better place?"
"It's a splendid place," agreed Christian without conviction.
"I've seldom seen so fine a place," chimed in Big Tiger.
"I mean for camping," said Good Fortune.
"We have everything here."
"Oh, yes," said Christian. "For camping, of course."
He looked around, but could not see what Good Fortune alluded to, so he picked up the pail.
"Leave that there," Good Fortune ordered. "We are remaining on this bank. The truck must stand further away this time," he continued, "as we've got wood to burn. That's why we don't need a tent. Greencoat doesn't understand that. How could he? He's always done his traveling in comfort, with tents and everything, just nicely on the fringe of the desert and always on the go. He's a cowardly fellow and as lazy as sin. Look at him sitting there, just as if he was painted on the rock, enough to make a man quit. Phew!"
"Shall I get Greencoat away?" asked Christian, as he happened to step on Big Tiger's toe.
"Perhaps for half an hour?" suggested Big Tiger.
Good Fortune laughed. "He'll never be able to do it," he said.
"We're ready to tackle anything," declared Christian eagerly.
"We undertake the most difficult commissions," asserted Big Tiger. "I only ask our esteemed elder to state his wishes." "Very well," said Good Fortune, amused. "See if you can get him away for half an hour, or anyhow, until the rice is cooked."
"Compass Mountain will see to that," said Big Tiger.
"Bolna," said Christian, carrying the pails to a level spot which looked suitable for making a fire.
"What are you going to do?" asked Big Tiger quietly.
"You'll see," said Christian, and he walked across the boulder-strewn region toward the ravine, as if he wanted to examine the neighborhood. Big Tiger looked after him, and Greencoat, who had heard the crunching of the gravel and the clatter of the stones, looked too.
"Hello!" shouted Christian suddenly. Though he was a good way off, the words were audible. "There's something queer here!"
"What is it?" Big Tiger shouted back. "You won't believe me, but I'll show them to you later."
"What will you show me?"
"Silver boxes! They're lying about here! It's very queer! I won't come back till the meal is ready."
"I'll call you."
"Better shout," called Christian. "I'm going a bit up the mountain."
"I'll sound the horn. Can you hear that?"
Big Tiger jumped into the driver's cab, and when he sounded toot, 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 Greencoat stood up slowly.
"You're making an awful noise," he complained. "It's outrageous."
At this, Big Tiger honked again. Greencoat put his hands to his ears and said, "I can't stand this din." He walked off, sometimes slipping, but with dignity for all that, over the gravelly basin toward the slope, where Christian stood beckoning him excitedly. He even ran part of way to meet him.
"Mr. Greencoat," said Christian, "could you please tell me in what year this silver botz was minted?"
"In the third year of the One Shi Kai government," Greencoat declared. "That's when they minted the best silver."
"I've heard that before," said Christian. "They don't make good coins any more. They put too much copper in them, the rogues."
"Where did you get the botz?" asked Greencoat.
2 paces from the caravan road, at the entrance to the ravine.
You should look around a bit. Perhaps someone walked up here with a hole in his pocket."
"That's right," said Greencoat, and both climbed to the edge of the ravine and looked around, right and left. "There's nothing here," said Greencoat.
Christian remained a few paces behind, dipped into his pocket, and took out 3 silver pieces. Then he bent down quickly and shouted, "Here are 3 together! He showed them to Greencoat, who smiled sourly, murmuring,
"Congratulations on unexpected wealth."
Christian then went on ahead into the ravine, where the evening shadows were falling on the rocks, making his search more difficult.
"You have to bend down," he advised Greencoat. "Then you'll still be able to see quite well."
Greencoat bent down, and if there was a silver botz there, he would certainly have found it. But there were none, until Christian went on a bit ahead. He had put the silver coins back in his pocket, with the exception of 1, which he held in his hand. When he went around the next bend and Greencoat could no longer see him, he ran quickly up the slope.
"You shouldn't run so far ahead," cried Greencoat from below. "You could fall and break your bones."
"I didn't think of that," Christian called back.
He quickly laid a botz in the loose gravel in a place where it could not fail to be found. Then he turned back and met Greencoat at the top of the bend.
"I hardly think there are any further up," he said. "If you don't mind, I'll sit down here and rest a while."
"That's all right," boomed Greencoat. "I'll take a bit of exercise. A man gets quite stiff sitting in that truck."
He went on searching, and Christian watched him furtively as he bent hastily to pick up something. Then Christian looked down into the valley where the truck stood, and the setting sun was shining over the dunes. Everything down there was thrown into sharper relief in the fading light, and the lengthening shadows made things stand out more than in the daytime. The stream of boulders emptied itself like a cascade into the stone basin, which overflowed and at one point took the form of 2 banks. On one stood the truck, and on the other the trees, and there Christian saw a spiral of blue smoke rising steeply skyward. The long rays of the sun lit up 2 figures, crouching near the fire. Good Fortune and Big Tiger were discussing the best way of preparing rice, and incidentally, Big Tiger was relating other things as well. "I found something," he began, delving in his pocket. "It looks like a cartridge, but I don't know to whom it belongs."
"Show me," said Good Fortune.
Big Tiger handed it to him, remarking that it was a very small caliber cartridge and perhaps might fit Good Fortune's pistol. He should try it, because then he would have another shot if it ever came to a fight. Good Fortune took out his pistol and found the magazine empty. He stared. Then he opened the holster, but there were no cartridges in it either.
"Ha!"
he cried, and then again, "Ha!"
and then suddenly, "Some scoundrels have robbed me. My cartridges are all gone."
"Of course, one can't say who did it," said Big Tiger coolly, "but Greencoat has got quite a lot in his pants pocket."
"I'll shoot him dead," cried Good Fortune, pushing the cartridge into the breech. "I'll do that as sure as I live. There's no greater scoundrel going than that foul fellow, and I'm only surprised that the rascal is still walking around alive. Heaven and earth are boundless, but his appointed end awaits every man. This is a good place for finishing him off."
"Perhaps, if the honored gentleman would wait a bit," said Big Tiger.
"Why should I wait?" cried Good Fortune. "If you knew what I know, you wouldn't talk of waiting. I know my cartridges, and this is one of them. Now I've loaded my pistol, and when Greencoat comes, he'll be surprised how quickly a man can be shot dead."
"Wisdom forbids anger," Big Tiger objected.
"That's a saying of your grandfather," scoffed Good Fortune.
"My grandfather says you don't get any young tigers if you kill the old ones too soon. Greencoat may be useful to us in the end. You never know." Having said this, he fell silent. Good Fortune, too, fell silent, and each had his own thoughts. Big Tiger perceived that Good Fortune was thinking of all the money he would like to get from Greencoat. Suddenly he shouted, "The rice is burning!" Good Fortune jumped up horrified. "The wood fire was too hot," he lamented. "Oh, woe, woe, that such a thing should happen to me! Haste brings misfortune. I shall lose face. What will Greencoat say when he tastes burned rice?"
"He'll say nothing," countered Big Tiger. "He'll be a corpse lying around here somewhere."
Good Fortune frowned. He wanted to speak, but he couldn't. The sun floated fiery red over the sea of sand, and the shadows grew deep and purple. "The honored gentleman," suggested Big Tiger, "has now got a cartridge. He can shoot Greencoat dead whenever it is urgent to do so. But Greencoat knows nothing of this, and thinks nothing can happen to him. That's why he is becoming impertinent and indiscreet. And Mr. Good Fortune is at an advantage. I think that's as clear as the sand at the bottom of the water."
"You've got a wise head," said Good Fortune. "I'll put off the great act of justice for a while."
"Will the honored gentleman also please not show that he knows anything?"
"No, I won't let on to anything."
"Then Compass Mountain and I shall try to take the rest of the cartridges from Greencoat when we get a chance."
"How will you do that?" cried Good Fortune, and he shook his head. But then he said, "I believe you two will turn out a pair of regular devils."
"We undertake the most difficult assignments," Big Tiger assured him. "Is the rice done?"
"Yes, it's done," sighed Good Fortune, "and it can be eaten, but it doesn't taste very nice."
"We two have a special liking for burned food," said Big Tiger, going over to the truck. He got up behind the steering wheel and sounded the horn 4 times. Christian heard it, but Greencoat, who had climbed up all the 6 twists of the road to the top, did not hear it.
"Chofan! Food! Food!" shouted Christian, but he got no answer.
"Perhaps Greencoat has answered all right," thought Christian, but he did not bother to make sure, and hopped joyfully from stone to stone down the slope.
"There's rice!" Big Tiger called up to him, laughing happily. This told Christian that their position was 5 times better than it had been half an hour ago.